Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Okay, guys, welcome back. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. Wrapping up today with Scott Paul from Oxfam. And they have this media briefing. Yemen struggling to break the fast. Welcome to the show, Scott. How are you?
Doing okay. Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. So let's see, I guess basic background, as you say in here, Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen for about 4 months now. According to the Wall Street Journal, it's American spies and military men are controlling the airspace and picking the targets. It's really an American kind of proxy war there, bombing the Houthis in an attempt to reinstall the last dictator, Hadi. And so now you guys are talking about the humanitarian impact here, and I think it's been, if the war's been 4 months, it's been at least, you know, three and a half months since we first were told, at least by Patrick Coburn, if not others, that the Yemenis import as much as 90% of their food, and that under this blockade and war, we can only expect them to start starving to death basically immediately unless something is done to end this conflict. Is that about right?
Yeah, that, yeah, we couldn't agree more on that part of that ending the conflict. You know, Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. It has been for a long time. Even before this stage of the conflict began, it had the second highest malnutrition rates in the world. Since coalition-led airstrikes began towards the end of March, the conflict has only escalated. And since then only, we've seen about 1.3 million people displaced within Yemen. And the numbers are really staggering, and they don't even do justice to the nightmare that people are living in. There's now 21.1 million people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance to survive. That's about a bit more than 4 out of every 5 people in the country. So a ceasefire and a political solution can't come soon enough.
Okay, now, so now, when it comes to whatever local crops, I mean, somebody's got to be growing something. I know we're talking about the Arabian Peninsula here, but, I mean, is it really right? 80, 90% of their food is imported? It's kind of amazing that the population was able to grow that much beyond what food that they can grow themselves would provide. You know, it's the magic of markets, but I guess it does leave them very vulnerable at the end.
It does.
In a crisis like this.
It is a staggering statistic. And Yemen is reliant on imports, not just to meet its food needs, but also to meet its fuel needs. And that's been a double whammy. It's been a 1-2 punch because what food is produced within the country, just as what little food is able to be imported, if there's not fuel to move it around, people aren't able to access it.
Right.
So, this, as you said, it's a country that's immensely vulnerable to outside pressure. And it's now been effectively isolated by from the international community and from its trading partners with whom it's had historically a very close relationship.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about this, though. So we're 4 months on, and I don't know. Do you have numbers for how many people you estimate have already died of hunger or starvation or you know, malnutrition and I guess, you know, whatever diseases that hit along with that level of weakness that gets lumped in with, you know, basically you could call it starved to death already. And how many more? I mean, it seems like if their markets are completely shut down, their imports are completely shut down, the war continues to rage. So many millions of them are on the brink of starvation. They can only be on the brink for so long before they actually starve. I mean, what kind of window of opportunity do we have to save these people's lives here?
Well, the window is already closing. It's tough to track exactly who is starving to death per se, but malnutrition has been simmering in Yemen for a long time, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Since this stage of the fighting began, At least 4,000 people, and we estimate it's much higher, but at least 4,000 people have died just from the violence alone, over half of those being civilians. And again, we think it's more than that. There's been almost 20,000 people who've been injured from that violence. And it's, when you have these staggering malnutrition rates, coupled with hospitals that aren't working, with people who, by and large, are only able to access unclean and unsafe drinking water, you get an incredibly high risk of disease that could go from 0 to 60 in about 2 seconds. And that's really what we're most concerned about, is this combination, this lethal cocktail of violence, malnutrition, disease, and other impacts of this lack of sanitation and water distribution. You know, I've had colleagues tell me they walked through some of these devastated cities in Yemen, and it's like a scene out of Blade Runner. You have piles of garbage on either side of the street just festering, and there's no fuel for local authorities to pick it up and move it somewhere where it's not going to be infecting people. So it's the combination of all of these factors that's really most worrying.
Yeah. Well, and Matthew Akins was on the show, snuck into the country through the blockade across the Red Sea, got into Yemen and went and reported from the northern province province there, right there adjacent to the Saudi border, and, you know, basically described it. I don't mean to put words in his mouth. I forget exactly, you know, what he called it, but he basically described a place that looked like the pictures of the Gaza Strip after the war last year, of just, you know, Europe after World War II ended, those pictures of Germany we see or whatever. The place is just devastated, where they clearly... Well, again, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I think it was pretty clear that it was indiscriminate bombing here. Not, you know, oops, we accidentally hit, you know, these civilian targets, but let's just take out this neighborhood and this neighborhood and that neighborhood.
Yeah, Sadat governorate in the far north is the one that's probably suffering most of all. About 80% of its people are going hungry right now, and 50% are in critical at a critical level in terms of food security. They've also had to deal with some of the most devastating airstrikes. And it's interesting that, you know, he said he has, you know, he concludes that it's indiscriminate because, you know, we're not an investigative agency. We're there to provide humanitarian assistance. And so, you know, it's difficult for us to draw legal conclusions about who's bombing indiscriminately or who's targeting civilian infrastructure. But the level of destruction is just jaw-dropping. And I think there's, you know, it's easy to make that inference when you look at the hundreds of civilian sites that have been damaged through the airstrikes and through the ground fighting as well since this stage of the conflict started. You know, you have hospitals, schools, religious centers, bridges and main roads, and collectively what it all means is that people aren't able to get the basic services that they need, even from aid agencies that are there and able to deliver some help, because you know, they need to at least be able to leave their homes in a safe way and go to a place that's a little bit safer, or go to a place where services are being are being carried out.
Mm-hmm. Man, and then, you know, the bad news, of course, is that the former government backed by the Saudis is now making headway in the port town of Aden, and they brought in, I don't know how many, but very many tanks from the United Arab Emirates, and so they look like they're just starting the next phase of the war here. It is not their intent on putting Hadi back on the throne in Sana'a, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, all of the parties at the moment are taking a maximalist position. Everyone from the Saudis to the armed groups on the ground, each of them with their own interests, and other players in the region who now have been involved militarily. We've seen a really startling uptick over the past half a year or so of arms going into Yemen and going to parties that are fighting in Yemen. And the result of all of that is that what had been a set of political grievances and political disagreements have now crystallized and hardened into sort of deeply entrenched military conflict. And it's in everyone's interest in Yemen for these parties to put down their arms and agree on a political solution that's inclusive of all of the different groups that have an interest there.
Yeah.
And at the same time, none of them are willing to give up on their dreams of total control and imposition of their authority.
Right. All right. Well, can you stay one more segment with us here?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to.
Okay, great. Hang tight right there, everybody. It is Scott Paul from Oxfam. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up for the week here. Talking with Scott Paul from Oxfam. We're talking about the Saudi-American war in Yemen. It's Saudi planes, but it's, of course, the Americans are the ones running the entire air traffic control and everything, picking the targets, according to the Wall Street Journal. So it belongs to us. But, Scott, I think part of the problem... part of the effect, you characterize it as a problem or not, I guess, part of the effect of having it a kind of halfway outsourced war means there's much less attention paid to it. It's not being considered an American war. Obviously, it's really hard for reporters to even get in there past the blockade like Matthew Akins did. There's very little journalism coming out of there, very little incentive, I guess, for especially American reporters to even cover the thing. I wonder if anybody even noticed when you guys put this report out. You could watch CNN for a week and not even know there's a war in Yemen at all.
Yeah, I think you're spot on that the difficulties that journalists have had getting into the country has really limited the ability of organizations like ours to spotlight just how much people are suffering. The journalist you had on sounds like he managed to get in. Great job to him. When we put reports out like this, our goal is to really spotlight just how much people are suffering, and also what needs to be done to bring this conflict to an end and to end that suffering. There's a lot of individual journalists, I think, who are very interested in this, but since people can't take pictures, see just how horrible the situation is, can't talk to individuals who were affected quite as much, there's a limited resonance. So it's important that you've invited me onto the show and that other journalists continue to pay attention to this as it goes on. But you're absolutely right. It's funny. You mentioned this is it's an American-owned war. Inside Yemen, a lot of people think of this as a Saudi-American conflict. And the U.S. role in this conflict has been really confused. On one hand, the U.S. has talked very vocally about the need for a political solution. President Obama, in fact, called the King of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, and had a conversation about the need for political solutions. And at the same time, it's been reported that U.S. military personnel are coordinating on operations, offering logistical and intelligence support, and, of course, selling massive quantities of arms to Saudi Arabia. And I think what we would want to see is we would want the U.S. to make itself very clear that when we say political solution is needed, it means we're not going to support one of the parties to the conflict anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's as simple as that. America is the 800-pound gorilla in this situation, especially concerning the Saudis. Call the king, tell him it's over, it's over. Simple as that. And all that has to mean is, hey, I'm ordering the AWACS back to their bases, so sorry, right? That's the end of that.
They'll say they have limited influence, and it's certainly the Saudis that are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in this military operation, according to public reports, but the U.S. has a lot of leverage with a close ally, and frankly, to hear U.S. policymakers say that they want political solutions while they're heavily arming and supporting one of the parties to a conflict is pretty disingenuous and disjointed. It rings hollow for me, and I think to a lot of people in Yemen.
Yeah, afraid so. Now, so I know, or I guess I don't know, but I assume you guys are doing some lobbying here, right? Part of your staff, their assignment is to take this report to Washington, D.C., try to get a congressman or a State Department official to acknowledge it, to talk with you guys about a little something like that. Am I right?
That's what we do. A lot of different pieces to our mandate. First and foremost, we deliver assistance to the people who need it most. And that's our goal, is to reduce suffering. But we also see ourselves as a campaigning organization. And our view is, our goal there is to use our mouthpiece to promote justice and to end that suffering. So we distribute that report in Washington as well as in capitals around the world.
That's cool. And forgive me, I don't know too much about Oxfam, but you don't do the HRW amnesty thing where every once in a while you support a regime change like in Libya if it, you know, oh, look, a war for humanitarian purposes, we're buying it, that kind of thing. You guys don't do that, do you?
You know, I can't think of an instance where we support a regime change. We're an impartial organization, and so our right. our aim is to prevent suffering.
Cool. I mean, that's what they say, too, but, you know, sometimes it's not so consistent.
Yeah, well, unlike a lot of humanitarian organizations, sometimes we do speak out in favor of or in opposition to use of force in a specific situation, but it has to be an extraordinary situation for us to support the use of force, and it would have to be very, very specifically devoted to protecting civilians. And we'd have to have confidence that people on the ground want that and that it's reasonably likely to happen.
Well, I mean, that was the exact script. It was all lies, but that was the story for the Libya war in 2011, of course, that Amnesty jumped right on board with. But I guess you guys didn't. That wasn't quite good enough excuse for you, huh?
We didn't adopt that position. And here in Yemen, this is a case where it's very clear that the military objective, if all the parties continue to pursue their military objectives and you know, refuse to make some pretty common sense concessions that would end the suffering of 21.1 million people, that's unacceptable for us.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And back to Yemen and D.C., when you talk to the State Department, do they give any indication to you guys that there's any kind of time limit on this thing or, you know, onward to victory until Hadi rules the place again? Or do they even answer you?
Well, I mean, the State Department view, and I'll do my best to give them the benefit of the doubt and to sort of reiterate their position. Their position is that Yemen is a country in transition, and the administration of President Hadi is one part of that transition. And that irrespective of all that, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has decided to conduct this military campaign to restore that transition, and they are going to support the effort to restore the transition. I think you can imagine what the exchanges would be like between Oxfam, an organization like Oxfam that believes we need an immediate and permanent ceasefire to end the suffering of people in Yemen and the State Department. But ultimately, our views are falling on deaf ears at the moment. So I think there ought to be a very strong public awareness that this is a no-win situation. We've got a war in Yemen that's going on that's not really serving anyone's interest, and it's going to continue until someone finds some sense and agrees to start making some concessions for peace.
And you know what, man? I mean, this is a little bit beyond your mandate, I understand, but in this situation, it seems pretty clear that the Houthis, they bit off more than they can chew. They don't really want to rule Sana and the rest of the country. The Iranians, their friends, not their owners, advise them not to do it. And, you know, defending their own autonomy is one thing, but in other words, there is clearly room for negotiation here. You guys withdraw to there and we'll stop bombing you if you stop bombing us when we, you know, come to here and there and whatever, share power. I mean, in other words, there's nothing like a stalemate here. There's plenty of room for compromise set.
Yeah, you know, like I said, everyone is pursuing their maximalist military goals at the moment, when in reality there is a political deal to be had. One thing I think maybe worth pointing out is the UN Security Council has adopted one resolution over the past 4 months. And rather than insisting on a ceasefire, it's a resolution that was very one-sided and didn't really reflect the situation on the ground. It imposed a lot of conditions on one party, the Houthis, to abandon a lot of the positions they had taken up. And in reality, the Houthis had no incentive to do that at the time. So now we're in a position where other parties, like the Saudis and the coalition, are pointing to this resolution and saying, well, this has to happen before we make any concessions. Or, sure, we'll talk, but the talks have to be around how to implement these concessions that the international community has demanded of the Houthis.
Right.
And I think in order for peace to really take hold, in order for the parties to realign their incentives and end this conflict that's causing so much suffering, the Security Council needs to speak again and make clear that these conditions on the Houthis, they're not preconditions. They're not the exclusive objects of peace talks. They may be part of negotiations, but ultimately the international community's position has to be, we need a ceasefire. We need an opening of the sea, air, and land routes into Yemen that have much more potential than even our organization, organizations like ours, to reduce and relieve some of this suffering. We need to get back on a track towards a political solution.
Yep. All right, everybody, that is Scott Paul from Oxfam, sticking up for the people of Yemen. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
All right, y'all, that's it for the show. No show this Sunday because it's Fun Drive on KPFK, but I'll be back here Monday, noon to 2 Eastern time, 11 to 1 text time.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.